From UX Magazine, this is Invisible Machines. Did you know that the Iron Triangle is horse pucky? On this episode of Invisible Machines, NASA's longest-serving chief administrator, Dan Golden, is here to tell us why the triple constraint of better, faster, cheaper, choose two is a load of crap. I'm Josh Tyson, and as always, I'm joined by Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Together, Rob and I wrote Age of Invisible Machines. This podcast is where we continue the conversations we began in our book, often with some of the smartest people we can find, like Dan Golden. Having held NASA from 1992 to 2001, Dan was able to transform operations in the face of budget cuts by taking a faster, better, and cheaper approach. In this episode, we discuss how Dan embraced failure while keeping people safe on epic projects like the redesign of the International Space Station. We also talk about his profound 50-50 rule for talent acquisition, which has surprising connections to the great Michelangelo. Overall, Dan was eager to kick holes in common tropes about innovation, so buckle up for some real talk from salty sage Dan Golden. Invisible Machines is produced with support from OneReach.ai. Their GSX platform delivers turnkey private architecture for creating and orchestrating agents using any available AI models while offering enterprise-grade security and no vendor lock-in. Learn more about orchestrating AI agents for your team at OneReach.ai. The newly revised second edition of Age of Invisible Machines is available for pre-order now at the link in the episode description. Rob and I have updated our best-selling guide to agentic AI with new chapters on leveraging generative tools, building composable architecture, and advanced knowledge management. We've also included many of the insights that have been unearthed right here on Invisible Machines. So pre-order your copy today. Well, Dan, it's great to see you again. Welcome back to the show. Something that Rob and I talk about in our book is the idea of sort of like the better, faster, cheaper paradigm.
Yeah, no. Faster, better, cheaper.
Excuse me. Faster, better, cheaper. I knew I had that backwards. Being something of an iron triangle, or at least historically, right? Like you're supposed to only choose two and you can never choose three.
That's horse pucky.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because in our book, we say that, especially with the technologies that are available now and some of the strategies the companies can use to kind of integrate AI, you don't really have to choose just two anymore.
And don't give me this crap about AI.
All right,
things
I won't.
Things occurred in America in technology well before AI, and I never bought into the nonsense you could only have two out of three. And anyone who ever said that at any point in history doesn't know what the hell they're talking about and doesn't know how to efficiently build things and do the hard stuff.
So what's the trick then? How do you have all three? And is it like a constant state of having all three, or is it a balancing act? Like how were you able to keep all three going?
It's a highly focused thought process. It's really simple. I'll give you the equation. Look, you need to have a vision of where you want to end up. You don't ever want to go on some trail in a random way in the mountains, not knowing where you want to end up, because you could end up dead. So you need to have clarity of vision of what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be able to do it not with an absolute assurance or with a low level of insurance. Because if you need to have an absolute level of insurance, you're wasting time and money and you're shooting too low.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a low probability of success, you have an excuse for failure. So you need to have a 50-50. 50-50 is the perfect point, because every human being, every team has ability to stretch. and you just can't predict. So that's rule number one. Rule number two is that vision needs to be clear. And let me wax eloquent for a minute here. Uh-huh. Michelangelo was an unbelievable scientist, and he sculpted beautiful statues in marble. And I read about it in books, and I saw it on the web. Someone once said to Michelangelo, "Michelangelo, how do you carve such beautiful angels in marble?" And his response was, "I see the angel in the marble, and I carve until I set it free." Now think about what that's saying. Not like these people that have an excuse for failure. He's not like these people who don't plan. You know, they go on the trail and then they need the Forest Service or the emergency people to find them because they get lost. What he said was, "I see the angel in the marble. I see it. I see the final product. I know exactly what it's going to look like when I finish." And now this is Golden's interpretation of the great Michelangelo, so don't get too serious yet. So I see the angel in the marble, and I carve until I set it free. So he doesn't think what's the first shot going to be in some random path, random walk to get to the final product. He sees the angel, and he knows what the last shot's going to be, then the next to the last shot, the next and that, and he works himself all the way back to the beginning. So the first shot isn't random. He knows exactly the path he's going to take. And if a problem occurs, he adapts to the problem. So you need a vision. You need to look at it with 50-50 probability of success. You have an execution plan. You know where you're going. You know how you're going to get there. You need to be able to adapt. And then you build a team of people who are not afraid of doing the hard things. They don't start whining and crying. And they communicate with each other.
Hey, you talked about this 50-50 thing. I know you just mentioned it. Could you dig into that a bit? Our last talk, I really liked that. I thought it was valuable.
Well, let me give you an example of a test I give when I give a course in creative thinking. And I'll break the people into three groups. I'll ask people to come to the front of the room, and it's in a standard room, and I say, "Look up. Hold your hand up in the air, look up, and see if you think you could touch the ceiling." And generally, it's a little far away. So I'll get a group of people, and the first response is going to be, "Oh man, I could do it, no problem. Watch out for that person." Of course, it's physically impossible. So this person is having an excuse for failure. And then you'll get the others that say, "Well, if you lower the ceiling about 2.5 feet, I could guarantee I could touch it."
Right.
That's a loser. Get rid of them. And then you'll do an experiment. You'll find someone who's very thoughtful. And they'll say, "You know," they look up at the ceiling. And I'll say to them, "Well, what if you did some push-ups for a week or two before?" "No, no, Dan, that will not be enough. Could you drop the ceiling, I don't know, maybe 9 inches? If you drop the ceiling 9 inches, they hold their hand up, you know they got a stretch. But they thought it through, and they did an assessment, and they said, "Hey, look, I think I have a chance of making it. Hire that person. Hire that person." And life is not about guarantees. When you do the hard thing, you go through exactly what I just said. There's never, I've read books about a lot of people. One of the books that I just love is the book by Ben Rich about the Skunk Works.
Okay.
The Lockheed Skunk Works. He talks about how they built the SR-71 at a time when no one ever built a supersonic plane. And
is that the Blackbird?
The Blackbird, yeah.
Yeah, I was obsessed with that plane when I was a kid.
The temperature of the window in the front was 760 degrees Fahrenheit. they had to invent materials. So they started out, but at the core, they did this 50-50 assessment. Now, maybe they don't do 50-50, but they assess the probability. I'm simplifying it.
Right.
But I have found that a 50-50 chance is just at the centroid of where you really get tested, and that's the place you don't want to be 90-10. You don't want to be 10-90. 50-50, you have a really good chance. And that's... occasionally, you have to be prepared for failure.
Yep.
And one of the things that I had a very difficult time doing is explaining to the members of Congress that you cannot do faster, better, cheaper without having a few failures. Now, the key to it is don't have a failure at all costs when people are involved.
Right, right.
Because you could lose a life. On the other hand, you could never guarantee that every launch is going to be a success. So one other thing that comes to mind is when I was at NASA, we didn't have AI. We didn't have some of the expert systems. We had, I think, 600 people in launch control between the Cape and NASA Houston. And one of the things that always concerned me is the American public. They love the space program. The reporters used to ask me questions about details about nuts and washers on the damn shuttle. I needed to, and I always answered their questions. But the point is, people play a blame game. So when I went through the confirmation process, I knew the probability of the loss of a shuttle was 1 in 72, numerical. That's not a good probability. But the way you overcome it is with the brilliance of the human mind, and it bends, and it's right. able to deal with a 50-50. So because this was faster, better, cheaper, and because there was the potential for a loss of a shuttle crew, I took the position that I was personally responsible for the lives of the astronauts on the shuttle. And before every launch, I would tell the media and I would tell the visiting VIPs. I started out, I don't know, about 2 hours before launch. I am the NASA administrator. I'm personally responsible, personally, and accountable for the lives of the astronauts on that machine. This is not Disneyland. This is not a ride at Disneyland. Seven human beings are going to space to make America a better country. And if something goes wrong, it is my fault. And I'm telling you this because I don't want any one of those brilliant, wonderful people sitting at the console or the astronauts on the shuttle to be second-guessed by the media
right.
and make a stupid decision because they feel the pressure. I want them to know, in the end, I am responsible. I get to get the budget. I get to select the leadership. I get to interview the astronauts before every launch, and I talk to every single astronaut as the NASA administrator before every launch, and I put a syringe into their head to make sure that they understood the safety. But in the end, part of faster, better, cheaper is accountability.
Uh-huh.
The person in charge must be absolutely ready to take responsibility and never, never, ever blame a subordinate. When you build that bond of trust, it builds the confidence in the human beings. And what's amazing is people have an elasticity. They're able to stretch if they know that they have an open field to run in.
Yeah.
So those are the basic principles of faster, better, cheaper. And what really pisses me off is when I arrived at NASA, the average cost of a unmanned spacecraft, a robotic spacecraft, was $600 million. And the average time from authority to proceed till it was on orbit was 9.6 years. When I left NASA, the average cost of a spacecraft was $200 million. And the time of all the spacecraft, and during my tenure, we launched 184 things and 184 payloads, and 173 worked.
Wow.
So in my tenure, I lost 11, and this is faster, better, cheaper. And to the present day, I am excoriated for losing two damn spacecraft out of robotics, no human lives on Mars. And they all said faster, better, cheaper doesn't work. Screw them. These are the people who sit in judgment and are ready to go after the people on the consoles.
Yeah.
This is what happens in America.
I agree.
It's called the blame game.
Yes.
So faster, better, cheaper works when the leader stands up and takes personal responsibility and accountability.
I agree with that 110%. You talk about failure.
I got a little pissed off and testy on that, but so
that's good. I like
it.
Failing is learning, and having such a big team. I know you're really big on building stuff, not relying on others to build it.
Hold on a second. Let's have a little speech about failing.
Okay, let's do that.
Do either one of you have children?
I do.
Yes.
Have you noticed how they learned how to walk? Did they suddenly get up and walk?
Oh, no.
No, they fell down.
Yeah, you have to put pads on the corners of furniture. Like, that's the...
Boom! Another thing that's really exciting to do, and there's another metaphor I use this for, teaching a child to pick up a Cheerio. I have two daughters, and I ran the experiment with both of them. You watch how they learn by failing. You know, we had high chairs, and we put, I would spread some Cheerios in the high chair. Experiment number one was, how do you take your hand and move your fingers so you could actually pick up a Cheerio? It took multiple attempts, and then after they pick up the Cheerio, I let them taste it. You know, I'd have them take a Cheerio out of my hand so I give them motivation. It's not nice to make experiments with your children, but I did anyhow. So then they have to take their fingers, and they have to be able to know how to bring the fingers down, grab it, and now once they have it in their hand, how do they get it in their mouth without dropping it or hurting themselves or smacking into their tongue? And failing is part of learning. It's some children learn it sooner, some learn it later, but it's a complex system to try and move your fingers and coordinate it and know where the mouth is because you can't see it. You take your fingers and somehow over here is the mouth. So I want to emphasize our culture, because of technology, is setting such unrealistic expectations, these young people are not given a chance to fail because they have all these supportive tools. And we got to allow our children to fail. That's part of faster, better, cheaper in raising children.
Yeah. What about, I mean, learning from the failure, and you had a lot of teams all critically having to work together. I was thinking about how do they communicate, share knowledge? How do, like, how do people learn from other people? And how did NASA handle the knowledge sharing component?
Well, I deeply believe, you know, we're in a world now where I sit in a room and I peer into a laptop and I talk to people. And the dilemma that I have is everything is so highly focused that it's very hard to build teamwork. That people are succeeding or failing. They give good advice or bad advice. They make mistakes or don't make mistakes. When you're dealing with very difficult developments, when you're dealing with protecting human life, you need to sit in a room and eat together and get a little schnookered together. Now, I'm not promoting alcoholism. But what I'm saying is people need to have confidence in each other. And you need to build trust. You also need to build a sense that I really know this person. Wow, they have 4-year and 6-year-old children just like I do. I've gone through this with them.
They're also doing the Cheerio experiment.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so much in common between human beings. So when you're setting out on difficult tasks, you got to build understanding and trust. And it's amazing watching how a true leader is able to build a team, because a true leader is not yes, no, black, white, do this, don't do that, here's the instructions, go use AI, go figure this out. It brings in the human interaction, which is just as important as it was in 1992.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And many times I find in these brilliant high-tech firms, they don't go out enough together. Now, I'm not proposing breaking up families and doing... but you could certainly go to lunch as a team.
Right.
Or you could bring lunch in and everyone isn't in their cubicle working the full 8 hours. So the human touch, I am terribly concerned, is being neglected. And one of the things that I felt was most important when I went to NASA, there wasn't enough of the human touch.
Uh-huh.
I was on planes constantly going to each of the centers, having socials with the people. I even went to the local schools. And then I decided America was detached from the space program for many years. I went to every single state except one. I'm not going to say which state I wasn't in. But I'd take an astronaut with me. I'd take some scientists. We'd hold a science fair. We'd go to local schools, to the Rotary Club. And I worked to connect NASA, because the people in America are paying the bill. Everyone pays. I think it's $11,300 a year if you take all the people that pay taxes. It's their program. So you need to have connectivity, human touch. And without human touch, faster, better, cheaper doesn't work.
How does faster, better, cheaper correlate with like BHAGs? We kind of got into big, hairy, audacious goals last time we talked. Does the faster, better, cheaper approach flavor the way that you try to identify BHAGs or approach them at all?
let's separate variables here.
Okay.
Big, hairy, blank goals is nothing more than a hope, wish, or dream. Putting together an execution plan with a 50-50 probability of success is the antidote. So I remember in the 80s and 90s, that was a very popular expression, and I thought it was stupid because it has no meaning. Someone's telling me that this is a really difficult task. Yes, so what? I don't need you to tell me this is hard. What I need you to tell me is, how do you accomplish that? So I find that term to be nonsensical.
So some you guys
a BHAG without an execution plan and a commitment to deliver is a
and
waste
the right
of,
team.
It's a waste of breath.
I know, like, NASA's always doing things that haven't been done. And then you have some percentage of things that have been done. And it seems like sometimes people mix up those processes, you know, like that when you're working on something that hasn't been done, but you act like it has, you end up not doing that vision you were talking about. Like they sort of just jump into it because when things are like routine and you've done them before, you know, I guess the vision's less critical. NASA did so many things for the first time. Was there like a lot of routine stuff too, or?
Unfortunately, routine stuff feels good. You're delusional. In an agency that's exploration, routine in a business that's, you know, making cans of tuna fish. Routine is beautiful. No, you don't. You want to keep making that can of tuna fish for less and less money in a faster time and make it much safer to eat. No, nothing should ever be routine. Once you got something working, you need continuous improvement. And it's easy for a nation to get comfortable when you're very far ahead, which America was in the 90s. You get complacent and you begin to do stupid things like invent the term fabless manufacturing.
Let's analyze
what fabless manufacturing means. It took America more than a century to learn how to refine metals, more so than any. They had all the resources in America to go find the different precious metals, the unique things that you need in electronics or in making a refrigerator or a TV. And we began to get overwhelmed with our huge capacity when the dollar is worth so many much more than other places. And in the early 90s, America made a decision. Why do we have to build things? Why do we have to have mines that create waste, contaminate the air? Why do we have to build things when the efficiency is so much better if we go to fabless manufacturing? Now, what does that mean? It means America designs things and markets it. And we have the really hard part in building it going on elsewhere in the world. And guess what happened? The whole technical middle class of America, it fell out. Go to Detroit. Go to other places where there was heavy manufacturing. Go to what's happening in America today with a lot of the jobs. And now all of a sudden we're saying we have no supply chain. What we need to do is rebuild the supply chain. Well, the horse is out of the barn. Now we're trying to get the horse back in the barn. So we opened up the barn doors. So I believe there's a capacity to do that. But every time a society gets lazy and wants to just get on the high end of the financial curve, you pay a price.
You mentioned that that shift started in the early 90s. Was that something that was immediately apparent while you were working with NASA? Was that something you had to contend with right away, or was it happening in other industries?
It happened with the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Oh, yeah.
And the election of 92 and the process that America went through. Now, I'm not saying anyone was bad. I'm just saying it was an economic experiment. But it was very clear. And initially, it was with Canada and Mexico. But then America went to the World Trade Organization and said, we want China in the World Trade Organization. Well, take a look at where we are now. Is there anything you could buy that doesn't come from China? In fact, if you want to build electric cars, you got to get the rare earth materials from China. America set up a mine here in California. And every time they started getting rare earths coming out of the neodymium and dysprosium, the Chinese, which controlled the world market, they just dropped the price. And the Mountain Pass mine went out of business twice. They went bankrupt because the Chinese were controlling the market. So there are consequences to not having the full value chain in the country. We're getting smart now. We're getting smart. And for the last 3, 5, 6 years, America's been trying to build back that supply chain and using advanced technology, not just doing the old stuff, but doing the hard stuff. And in fact, in America today, one of the most exciting things is the new industrialization. There are a bunch of brilliant young people. They formed an organization called the New American Industrialization Association. And these are the kids that are using generative AI. They're using robotics, three-dimensional robots, not robots that are hanging on an arm. They're using additive manufacturing. They're bringing it all together. And magically, what they're doing, and I'm involved in a lot of that stuff. I just love it. But what's being done is so essential. I could now come up with a three-dimensional design of something. I put it into a machine that builds a generic model. It's a brilliant company. It's called Zoo, run by, I think, a 28-year-old woman. She's the CEO. And they're able to instantly send instructions to a CNC machine. No drawings, no nothing. Ba-boom. This is what's going to be the rejuvenation and the hope for jobs in America and the hope for really terrific economics. But this stuff is hard. And these young people had to go out and raise the money and take the risk. There's another incredible company. It's called the Divergent 3D. Founded and run by a fellow named Kevin Zinger. They're using AI and additive manufacturing, and they're cutting the cycle time for building auto parts and defense parts by factors of 3 and 5 and 10. This is the new America industrialization, womb to tomb, and we just got to get away from taking the easy path. You got to live in pain. You got to do it difficult. You got to take on the hard stuff and have a 50-50 chance of making it. That's what these young people are doing. I just love them.
Is that part of the secret sauce, sort of, that because you're sort of competing with cheaper goods in a way, right? And so if you want to have end-to-end production, efficiency seems like a big place where you can make up some of that. Elias, our producer, was telling me about a bike company in Toronto. I think they're called Bridge Bike Works, and they're their whole goal was just to figure out how that they how they could make end-to-end bicycles out of carbon fiber all in downtown Toronto, and kind of dealing with all the challenges that came with that. What has your experience been in terms of like how you can turn that into a sustainable business? Is part of it just living through that pain period that you're talking about?
No, let me come back to fundamentals.
Okay.
Have a vision. Do analysis to make sure that you work backwards and have a path to get there. Do some early experiments and do some analysis. And there's some tools we have now you could do a digital twin. Before you build anything, you could digitize the whole thing and run the process. Won't guarantee success, because you're making some assumptions. But do those things that are affordable, that retires the risk down. And remember, I do a lot of due diligence with young companies. And every time I see someone talk about doing something really hard, but can't substantiate the projects, doesn't understand the physics, hasn't laid out the odds, hasn't done some digital modeling, the tools are there. You could minimize the risk, but you can't make a gut of zero.
Yeah.
So life
we had
about
a great conversation with Dr. Michael Greaves about digital twins. And that is a really good point. That is such a powerful way to kind of at least eliminate some of the unknowns, right? You can, if you have a sophisticated, nuanced digital twin, you can really cut some of that away.
Yeah. But when you're starting a company, you can't build a sophisticated digital twin. There isn't enough money.
Yeah,
this
true.
Comes back to vision and judgment,
mm-hmm.
and the ability to conceive and test. And having a truly high fidelity digital twin, if you have that working, you're much better probability than 50-50. And again, the reason I say 50-50 is when you're starting a company, doing something new, you'll never have the resources to be sure. So you need that inner telescope, mm-hmm. that inner clock that says good enough. Good enough. And many new companies try and build such precision, they burn up all the resources before they could actually build it and show that it works. So life is not yes and no, black and white. You got to live with shades of gray and know how to tell one shade of gray from the other.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that kind of classic explore, exploit, and finding that sweet spot.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, Dan, this has been very, very illuminating, and thank you very much for your time, and really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, Josh, it was great talking to you and Rob. I wish you the very best, and remember, Michelangelo.
Michelangelo. I won't forget. All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine. Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.